Blog Talk Radio.
Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Crystalline Beek Larson and Andre Rodatis. Hi, you guys.
Good morning.
Hey.
Good morning. So good to hear your voices this morning. And we have a great show today, I think. A returning guest and wonderful friend, longtime friend of ours, Mr. Steve McIntosh. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Paula. Hi, Andre and Crystalline. Good to be with
good
you.
Morning.
Good morning.
It's so great to have you. So just by way of introduction for our guests who may or may not be familiar with your tremendous work, Steve is emerging as a premier integral philosopher and somebody who's been involved in the movement of integral philosophy since 1999. Is that correct, Steve?
Yeah, more or less.
More or less. And he's written now two books, and what we're specifically talking about today is Steve's new book that he just launched officially, and we were at a party last night at his house for this launch. It's called Evolution's Purpose, An Integral Interpretation of the Scientific Story of Our Origins. So thanks for being on our show. I'm so glad you're here. What is the gist of why you wanted to write this book, Steve? And maybe you can give us some background on, you know, what brought you here and your other book as well.
Sure. Thanks. Well, to sort of give the short story, ever since the 1970s when I kind of first encountered what the best label for it's probably progressive spirituality.
Mm.
This was, in the 70s, after the 60s had kind of, you know, run its course. One of the next steps for many who were involved in the counterculture and for looking for alternatives of every kind in the 70s was alternative forms of spirituality. And this was an eclectic mix of the discovery of esoteric forms of Western spirituality, the transplantation of many of the wisdom traditions of the East, types of understanding of shamanic spirituality and earth-based forms of spirituality. There was a kind of an opening up of a pluralistic cultural agreement whereby claims of exclusivity about any particular spiritual path were banished, and there was a whole generation of seekers who were looking for new ways to experience spirit that were really outside of the traditional religious forms that they may have been raised in. And I was drawn into this and discovered and read many books in the 70s, both East and West. For this program, it's notable to say that one of my favorite books that I encountered in the 70s was The Arench Book, and that that definitely opened my eyes to lots of spiritual realities. It also gave me a focus on the juice or the exciting part, for me at least, of progressive spirituality in the 70s. Was the areas wherein science and spirit seemed to overlap, where discoveries of science, in a sense, were pointing to spiritual realities that weren't dependent on any particular spiritual teaching or authority, you know, that you could see it in the physical universe. I remember in 1977, I grew up in Los Angeles, and I went to UCLA to see a lecture by two luminaries in the science and religion field as it was emerging. One was Fritjof Capra, who wrote the kind of breakthrough book, The Tao of Physics, right? Sort of his claim was that, you know, the discoveries of the deepest levels of physics, such as quantum physics, were confirming many of the insights that had been held by the sages and mystics of the East. And while it was a beginning effort, and he kind of pushed it too far, and there's many critiques we could level against that book now, it certainly was an important book that got a lot of attention in the mid-70s. I also remember seeing at that same time Marilyn Ferguson, who wrote another excellent book in that field called The Aquarian Conspiracy, which in some ways was a really seminal book in the emerging culture of progressive spirituality. So anyway, without going too much into the origins of progressive spirituality, you know, it continued through the 80s. It really had a flowering or a kind of a fluorescence in the 90s, where we saw thousands of New Age bookstores opening up and a significant market, you know, for books and seminars and retreat centers. I mean, it was definitely a big part of the culture, even though the term New Age is kind of a term of derision, and although now it kind of stands for the more immature elements of progressive spirituality, you know, at the time, we all felt like there was a kind of a spiritual renaissance going on within alternative spirituality, and it had many deep intellectual strains, which, again, the unification of science and spirit being one of the most exciting to me. But by the late 90s, I began to really see that the spiritual renaissance we'd hoped that would transform the society was really not delivering. I mean, it wasn't as if progressive spirituality had achieved a kind of a fluorescence, but it still remained countercultural. There were still elements of it that were rejected by the mainstream media, by academia, by people of good sense and good faith in the society. They just didn't see really any of the elements of progressive spirituality as providing an alternative to either, you know, a regression to mythic forms of spirituality. You know, there was just no, you know, the spiritual leadership that we hoped that it could bring to the agreement forming potential of it. Was lacking. And I think through integral philosophy, looking back on that time, you know, in the late 90s, we can see why progressive spirituality really failed to unify the society at a higher level of spiritual recognition. And it was partially because of the shortcomings of progressive spirituality and its immaturities, despite its accomplishments, that I was drawn to seek something that transcended that, something that was beyond that. And when I encountered integral philosophy in 1999, I mean, through Ken Wilber, but also through Teilhard de Chardin, and kind of this understanding of the structure of cultural evolution that was brought about by the book Spiral Dynamics, which became popular in progressive circles in the late 90s and early 2000s, it really felt like there was a movement emerging that was distinct from progressive spirituality, that was more intellectually rigorous, that had the potential to achieve things which progressive spirituality couldn't by way of a deeper understanding and a more broad-based agreement. And so I kind of dedicated myself to the integral philosophy movement. At first, I was associated with Ken Wilber's Integral Institute, But then I realized that my contribution needed to be made as a kind of an independent voice, which led to my first book, Integral Consciousness, which served as a kind of a reframing of integral philosophy, a kind of a basic introduction to it in the first half, and then my attempt to add to the body of the philosophy through some more intellectually rigorous elements in the second half. And so that book was well received. I kind of entered more thoroughly within this movement of integral philosophy. It's now, there are two terms that are being used in the culture. One, of course, is integral, which has its, strengths and weaknesses. The other is evolutionary, which, of course, is a takeoff on the word, revolutionary, but it's been popularized extremely well by Carter Phipps' book, Evolutionaries, which came out in June. And that's kind of a journalistic overview of this movement, which I highly recommend to anybody who wants to kind of understand where this has come from and where it's going and how it's distinct from
What's the name of his book?
It's called Evolutionaries.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And it reads, it goes down like honey. I mean, it reads like a journalistic magazine article, even though, of course, Carter's a great writer and he's a good thinker and he develops, the philosophy. I mean, the book is meaty and intellectual, but it's also entertaining and fun to read, and that's why it's serving the movement, because it's kind of making it, seem less nerdy and a little bit more, contemporarily relevant, maybe even sexy, So, so
Sounds
Carter's
fun.
Book, Evolutionaries, kind of is kind of a complement to my book, Evolution's Purpose, both of which are sort of, the latest emergence, the latest offerings within this living, growing philosophy, which, I think the best label for it at the moment is integral philosophy.
Mm.
So kind of just to explain to the readers, what is integral philosophy and what it's good for. It's good for a variety of things. I think most importantly, it's good for helping us understand with greater detail and more thorough depth what's going on in our culture, what's going on in our world. Why the world is so messed up in certain ways, why there's still reason to have hope, why we don't have to assume that our civilization is, headed for a significant decline. I think that properly applied, the insights of our growing understanding of what evolution is and how it's working on the inside of us as well as on the outside, how it's more than just biology. It's the universe's ceaseless process of becoming, and it's the biggest thing we know, right? I mean, the universe, evolution isn't really something that's happening within the universe. It's more like that evolution is the universe. The universe is evolution happening.
It is the creative process, kind of.
Right. And so there's so much truth there in what science and history have, kind of now in the last few decades, there's really been a kind of a consolidation and an emergence of our understanding of all this. There's so much truth there that we can't help but miss, we do well not to miss the spiritual truth that's associated with it. So Evolution's Purpose, first and foremost, is a book which attempts to help the reader discern the spiritual message of evolution that is there all along in the scientific facts themselves. And that deeper understanding of evolution can lead directly to a more evolved world. I mean, not only in terms of the problems of the global problems facing our world. I mean, certainly that's one of the things that integral philosophy can help with. But perhaps more importantly, this deeper understanding of evolution itself can help us understand what we're trying to do, right? Spiritual growth can be understood as a form of evolution. And when we can understand evolution in its fine strokes, how it partakes of values, how it aims for the transcendent, how it's about dynamic quality, these are things that that can be used in one's life in very practical ways. I mean, the book's not a self-help book. It doesn't have 12 steps to evolutionary consciousness or something, but it does go beyond merely an intellectual description of science and attempts to deliver usable, livable spiritual truths.
So you have often told me that, you know, and clearly you're comfortable in the deeply intellectual, philosophical aspects of this movement, but you have often expressed to me that you thought that it was lacking somewhat in spirituality, and you really wanted to help it cross that bridge and tie spirituality in more prevalently. Do you think that you, I mean, is that part of the purpose of this book? It seems like it to me. I haven't had a chance to start reading it yet. I just got it last night. But just looking at the contents, the table of contents, makes me think that you've really added a spiritual element.
Well, evolution is the creation story of our age. I mean, certainly there are, you know, millions, billions perhaps in the world who retain a worldview that is pre-modern, right? That the origin story, which they use, comes from a form of scripture. And while there's truth, you know, deep truth in really all forms of the world's great scriptures, you know, much of the creation story that's behind those scriptures is at the mythic level, right? The idea that the world was created in 6 days, you know, may be an allegory for some deeper understanding of how the universe was created, with the idea of days being, you know, substituted for other mm-hmm. concepts. But certainly taking that literally is mythic. But for those living in the developed world who have achieved a modernist kind of mainstream university-based scientific understanding of the world, they know that evolution is true. That while certainly we don't know everything about evolution, that it certainly doesn't prove the universe is a random or otherwise deterministic accident. But the fact that the universe is about 14 billion years old, at least matter and energy and time and space as we know it, the fact that life emerged 3.5 to 4 billion years ago here on Earth, that it's descended from an early form of life through the process of biological evolution, that humanity has emerged from that biological context. These are all fairly well-established scientific facts that we carry in our bodies, we carry in our very being. And creation stories are very important, even though a lot of times we take for granted, you know, we may not dwell on the creation story that our culture provides us. But they're indispensable because you can't really have a foundation, a touchstone of what's real, if you don't have a creation story. Even if you sit and say, well, it's all ambiguous, I'm agnostic, I don't really know where all this came from, and no one can really know, that's still a kind of ambiguous creation story that can help in certain ways and not help in others. So just like we're using the foundation of the buildings that we're sitting in, we're using our creation stories as a way of framing reality, determining what's real, and thus orienting us toward a kind of particular take on what's beautiful, what's true, and what's good. And so one of my attempts in this book is to try to show how the creation story of evolution is actually a profound spiritual teaching in its own right.
Beautiful.
You know, it's a kind of revelation. And if we can come to sort of see the spirit that's being communicated to us in this story, this can allow us to continue to use the scientific story of our origins, but in a deeper way. And the real goal, the long-term goal, is to help to form, not just by me, but with the integral philosophy movement and the spiritual understanding of evolution that's growing in our culture, to help provide a form of spiritual leadership that transcends what's on offer in the culture today. For example, if you poll Americans, for example, a huge number report that they're spiritual but not religious.
Right.
And this the numbers who say they're spiritual but not religious are far greater than the demographic of people who adhere to progressive spirituality, right? So this is a mainstream who are willing to claim this. And for them, I think when you look out in the culture and see what's on offer in terms of spirituality, it's either a kind of the traditional form of spirituality, which for many is too mythical to embrace, or a new age form of spirituality, which is, you know, not intellectually rigorous, it's too countercultural for many to embrace, or, you know, some might see it as too immature or too fluffy. Mm-hmm. So that you know the spirituality that's visible in our culture to this large body of people who claim to be spiritual but not religious, right? They're not atheists. They know there's more to the universe than just matter in motion, but they haven't found a form of spirituality that they can be loyal to or otherwise become identified with. And this is where this deepening understanding of evolution, the spiritual message of evolution, provides hope for a kind of a transcendent form of spiritual agreement that can accommodate, that, you know, it can carry forward the evolutionary achievements of progressive spirituality in terms of its welcoming pluralism, but it can also overcome the problems of progressive spirituality, which is anything goes, and that, you know, some of the more magical thinking ideas, there's no standard by which we can compare all the different forms of spirituality that are welcome within the pluralistic agreement. Mm-hmm. And so this evolution itself kind of provides a semi-objective measuring rod for different spiritual teachings. It helps true up all the different forms of spirituality, even while it allows for different interpretations of the spiritual message. And just to summarize it, the spiritual message of evolution, as I argue for, as a thesis of evolution's purpose, is that evolution is indeed progressing toward greater realizations of the beautiful, the true, and the good, and that we are agents of evolution, and as we strive to evolve our consciousness and make the world a better place, we're fulfilling evolution's purpose, which is the gradual experience of making the finite universe gradually more perfect. Now, that sounds idealistic, and in the book I carefully explain how we deal with the problems of suffering and evil, how we account for the setbacks and the stagnation and the regressions that have occurred throughout evolution, how we overcome arguments that say that any estimates of progress are biased, you know, according to the interests of the observer who claims progress. I mean, evolution, there's a lot of detail in terms of the arguments that have been made, both in defense of a purely materialistic interpretation of it, as well as arguments that have been made about a kind of a more spiritual interpretation. But what's new about evolution's purpose is that I'm using the power of this new evolutionary philosophy. Integral philosophy sheds a whole bunch of light on the subject. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the ways I think the book makes a contribution.
Wonderful.
So one of the
go on, Andre. Can you hear us, Andre?
He's breaking up.
Yeah, he's breaking up.
Yeah.
Oh, that's no good.
No.
Yeah, we can hear about every other word you're saying there, Andre. So.
Oh.
I'll have to come up on that.
Maybe you want to call back or something, Andre.
Protocol. Can you? Am I still breaking up every second
no.
word?
Well,
a little bit better.
A little better.
A little better.
Yeah.
Okay. there's something that called the subject-object theory that described here. This process of cultural objectification is described by Kagan's subject-object theory. Kagan explains the progress of consciousness through the stages of development by observing a person transcends a given stage when what was previously embedded in a person's subjective consciousness becomes objectified or recognized an external perspective. According to Kagan, transforming our epistemology liberates.
You're breaking
in which
up
we are
again,
embedded.
Andre.
We can't.
It's just really hard to get a whole thought. Would you want to call back and then we'll try to do that question?
Yeah, sure.
I'll try and
call him. That gets me a better line.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
While Andre's doing that, I can at least say some general things about.
Okay.
He was reading from Evolution's Purpose there at the end in a section where I describe the elements of this evolutionary worldview. Just in terms of the structure of the book, the first seven chapters are really the philosophical argument, right? Staying
mm-hmm.
with science and not assuming any beliefs on the part of the reader, and indeed trying to render the philosophical arguments at the level wherein even people who are you know, not affiliated or not particularly drawn to any kind of form of spirituality can nevertheless see that evolution is a purposeful phenomenon, and then there is evidence for that. It doesn't require that one accept a kind of a theistic notion of the source of this purpose, but that creativity is kind of the ultimate matter of fact, as Whitehead said, that it is a creative process. We can feel it within us. And so the first seven chapters and the huge heart of the book is about that argument for why evolution is indeed progressive, and why this understanding about how evolution progresses points to evolution as a purposeful phenomenon, and it's something we can all experience directly. We don't need to just sort of take it as a philosophical argument. We can have an experiential understanding of this. And so that's the heart of the book. Mm-hmm. But then I allow myself in Chapter 8 to say, all right, I want to argue for three distinct approaches to truth: science, philosophy, and religion or spirituality. And although ideally these different approaches can inform each other, they can't be conflated, because their separation or their different domains of inquiry are important, because they're dealing with different kinds of experience, right? Science is dealing with our sensory experience. Spirituality is dealing, of course, with our spiritual experience. And philosophy works best when it both bridges and separates, where it helps science and spirituality to communicate with each other, but keeps science from colonizing spirituality or claiming all truth to itself, you know, and
mm-hmm.
vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the book, I try to draw a bright line and say, look, okay, the first seven chapters was about the philosophy, which is, you know, an argument which I believe should, you know, that if you take it seriously, it's meant to be compelling, it's meant to be agreement-forming, it's meant to be self-evident, and it's founded on what science can tell. Then I say, okay, but now we're going to go into a more spiritual interpretation, more theological analysis of the philosophy, and ideally I don't want that to be conflated with the philosophy, or to sort of say, well, it's philosophical arguments rise or fall, and then they attack the theology, which is necessarily more speculative. So I don't want to sound too defensive about it, but I care very much about these arguments being rigorous, because the whole point
right.
is to form an agreement. So Chapter 8 is a spiritual, it's entitled A Spiritual Interpretation of Evolution's Purpose. And so I go beyond, you know, the minimal metaphysics of the beautiful, the true, and the good that are in the first seven chapters. Then the final chapter, the last long 45-page chapter in the book, Chapter 9, is an overview designed for a mainstream skeptical audience of what the evolutionary worldview is. You know, what its promises, what its elements are, how it applies to politics, how it applies to spirituality, how it can be practiced. You know, what it means, like that. And in there is a section about this new way of seeing that is provided by the evolutionary perspective, and that new way of seeing helps us see the evolution of consciousness itself that's within people. In other words, people
mm-hmm.
in our society typically make meaning using more than one type of consciousness, right? They may have a traditional form of consciousness on Sunday and a modernist form of consciousness on, you know, Monday morning, and then maybe even partake of a postmodern form of consciousness with their friends on Wednesday night, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
so there are types of consciousness within people. And so it's important to understand that we're talking about a spectrum of consciousness. And this evolutionary way of seeing allows us to step outside of that spectrum a little bit and sort of look at it from the outside. What Andre was, you know, referencing in his reading about Keegan's subject-object theory.
Right.
Robert Keegan is a developmental psychologist who is a professor at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. Even though developmental psychology is, you know, a form of psychology, because it's developmental, because it claims to recognize a vertical dimension of development where some forms of consciousness are more evolved than others, you know, it has to sort of hide out in another department, because that's still pretty controversial within psychology itself. But developmental psychology as a field is over 100 years old, and it's had many luminaries, including Jean Piaget, who's probably the most well-known developmental psychologist. And Keegan is one of the successors of Piaget. He really sees Piaget as being his primary intellectual mentor. But Keegan has certainly gone farther than Piaget, because Piaget's stages of development, his understanding of the evolution of consciousness, was focused mainly on development within children. And Keegan, as well as developmental psychology overall, takes the process further by recognizing stages of development that occur within adult development, right? I mean, many people, once they become adults, their development is arrested, and they have the same worldview and the same values and the same understanding of the nature of reality when they're, you know, 64 as they had when they're 24. But for many of us, and especially those who actually feel a duty to try to develop their consciousness and grow spiritually, they have experienced growth in their perspectives. And it's not just a matter of greater knowledge and experience, you know, although that's certainly part of it. You know, moving towards self-actualization has a lot to do with your gift to the world, right? You know, that we become more evolved as we make the world more evolved. And so there's plenty of ways to do that. We could see perhaps Rick Warren is a self-actualized traditionalist, or Bill Gates is a self-actualized modernist, right? You can you can achieve, you know, levels of spiritual development within any one of these stages that is an important part of integral philosophy, this sort of structure. And I should mention that that's really one of the takeaways when I speak to a general audience, like at a bookstore, about evolution's purpose. One of the simple things that I want people to get as a memorable message of what we're talking about, even though the subject is, you know, wide and deep and you can kind of get carried away with any detail, you know, in an hour's interview down any particular road. But one of the takeaways is that this understanding of evolution, that can see how evolution is occurring in human history and culture and indeed within human consciousness, you know, although this psychosocial domain of evolution, this level of historical development, can't be conflated with biological. It's not the same as biological evolution, but it rests on top of and uses the accomplishments of biological evolution, just like biological evolution rests on top of and uses the accomplishments of the evolution of matter, right? Cosmological evolution. We need a planet. We need water. We need, you know, molecules. We need chemistry. We need physics in order to have biology. And without those accomplishments in place, biology can't emerge. But once it does, then we have this new domain of evolution. And then the same with psychosocial, right? We can't have the evolution of consciousness and culture unless we have brains that are capable of supporting the kind of consciousness that we're using right now. And it's all occurring using these mammalian bodies that we have. But even though our bodies may be not that different from the bodies of other complex mammals, what distinguishes us from the animal kingdom is that we can evolve our consciousness by evolving our culture in ways that produce this global civilization that we're now all participating in. So getting back to Andre's question quickly, the idea that you can, one of the ways, at least from a technical developmental psychology perspective, begin to experience this transcendence of a given stage is to recognize that a big part of the consciousness we have is culture speaking through us. Right. Some people are totally independently minded and they're not influenced by culture or what people think. At least they think so. But there's no getting away from it. And if you're using language, you're using culture. You know, and some people, in a sense, you speak to them and it's almost like they're puppets of the culture. Like the culture just determines everything they think. And so it's important to be aware that we're all, to a greater or lesser degree, embedded in the culture that we have grown up in and that we participate in. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But if we can gain the ability to step outside of our culture and see it from the outside as well as from the inside, that's one of the techniques or one of the elements of evidence that we can point to that demonstrates that consciousness is evolving, is that you're continuing to gain a higher perspective, gain higher ground on your own consciousness and your own culture.
Well, Andre is back with us now. Andre, are you there?
I have been following, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
okay.
Appreciate you going further in depth on that. So where that takes me in your thinking is to follow up with this, and that is, so you've had a background from a very early age with the Urantia book that acted as a foundation you know, when you did a lot of exploration of integral philosophy with Ken Wilber and then took it in your own direction, as I listen to you and I hear, okay, so this is one of the things that as I get a sense of where I am in the cultural context and where anybody else is, whether they're modernist, postmodernist, you know, whether according to Ken Wilber's thought, you know, are they functioning from you know, the Ouroboric, the Typhonic, the realm of mythic membership, you know, where are they in a particular set of consciousness? And knowing that none of us is very good at pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps, my question becomes, you know, how does anyone get to the point of being able to step outside of the culture enough to be able to do this for themselves? What is the actual technique? What is the way that the methods they can use along with the philosophical tools that you're proposing?
Yeah, sure. Excellent question. And it's important for me as an author describing where I'm coming from to be, especially on this program, clear about the fact that I've been greatly inspired by the Urantia book, and it has been an important part of my spiritual journey, and I continue to honor it and indeed read it. But it's not my belief system, right? I don't identify myself as a Urantia book reader or as a person who has loyalties to that religion. And so, you know, I'm happy to be you know, associated with it. But I need to be clear that I'm not coming from that position, or I'm not an advocate of that particular spiritual path exclusively. But going back to integral philosophy, I can say that part of the way to understand this is that looking at history and seeing how other worldviews have emerged in history, and the most well-documented and well-understood and least controversial emergence of a historically significant new worldview, which added to the evolution of consciousness and culture, which the emergence of modernism, which is a defined term within integral discourse, but it's also more generally recognized as the Enlightenment, right? The age of reason, you know, the scientific revolutions, the philosophical revolutions of the 17th and 18th centuries that led to democracy, that led to industrialization, that led to the ascendancy of the developed world for both good and for bad. Modernity occurred through the new insights of science, you know, brought about by Galileo and Newton, and by the philosophical attempts to frame that science into a new worldview, which we see, you know, beginning with Descartes, right, in the middle of the 17th century, and then continuing with the philosophers of Enlightenment, you know, Locke and Spinoza, and then, you know, Voltaire and Montesquieu, and eventually Kant, and even Hegel. The great tradition of Enlightenment philosophy really did form a foundation for this modern way of seeing things, and had extremely practical applications in terms of scientific medicine and, you know, technology and all the things that we rely on today. And the way that occurred, in a sense, was there was a new truth, a new way of seeing the world that that in a sense had the effect of demonstrating the relative untruth of the previous worldview, right? So Galileo showed the Earth revolves around the Sun instead of vice versa. And while we all take that fact today, that was destabilizing to the medieval established culture. And it called for a new frame of reality, which was supplied by the new truth of the subject-object distinction, which Descartes used to help create an objective view of the world, a new way of seeing that could allow science to physically grab hold of the stuff of the world with more detail and greater power. So it, you know, it emerged as a new truth, and that's for the first probably 100 years. It was only scientific and philosophical truth before it later then became new forms of beauty, right, with classical music, and, you know, new forms of technology, new forms of indeed government, you know, with democracy. So
interject there, Steve,
yeah.
Isn't it also because, you know, at the time, you know, part of what Descartes and others were doing, they were trying to break out of an ecclesiastically controlled model of thought, where essentially the only objective quote-unquote objective thought was to be in alignment with any thought that was coming from an ecclesiastical authority, like the church.
Right. That, so that, you know, the religion had, in a sense, usurped philosophy and science. Right. It all had
right.
to conform to religion. Yeah.
Okay.
And we can see something similar in our time, whereby science has attempted to usurp philosophy and spirituality. Indeed, being, you know, the only source of truth according to scientific materialism, which you know, many may have no problem rejecting, but that still dominates the academy. It dominates the corporate media. You know, even though not everyone is a scientific materialist, there aren't alternative arguments being asserted that are otherwise classified as mythical. So this, the way you use, to kind of get back to the heart of your question and make it relevant to the listeners, right? The way you get this way of seeing, the way you begin to use it, the way you can objectify, you know, your particular cultural position and see from outside of it in a new and powerful way is by a good way to put it is metabolizing. You know, if you look at at values like beauty, truth, and goodness as forms of spiritual nutrition, as forms of spiritual energy, then there's an analogy there with the metabolization of that energy, you know, bringing it through us, taking it in and giving it out, just like we would use, you know, physical energy of food by taking it in and then, you know, using it to power our bodies.
Making it functional.
Yeah. And so you know, there's many values that are being communicated with this new integral way of seeing things, but the core of it is this new truth. And the new truth is that consciousness evolves, that it has a structure to it, that structure is tied in with culture, that culture and consciousness evolve together, that the structure isn't merely a structure of technology or external, you know, artifacts, that the structure of the evolution of consciousness and culture has very much to do with values, with reality frames, with loyalties, with identity framing explanations of what is real. And so this integral perspective, it brings a wider and indeed deeper understanding of what's real, because it shows how these value frames each have a very important contribution, which is ongoing. In other words, the culture that we're using right now in this, the way we're thinking and having this conversation, is actually an ecosystem of culture that incorporates all of history within this very moment. In other words, the accomplishments of tribal consciousness, the accomplishments of traditional consciousness, the accomplishments of modernist consciousness are all being used to a greater or lesser degree to create this scale of emergence which is present in our very way of thinking and seeing now. And being able to see that in practical terms, in concrete, well, as concrete as consciousness and culture can get, seeing this structure, seeing that indeed there is a developmental structure and it is a living structure. It's not like geological strata just stacked on top. It's an interactive system whereby this understanding of reality that we have, depending on what our cultural allegiances are, does really determine what we can see, right? You know, when you have a new truth, you can see new things. And the new truth about evolution, its depth, its structure, the fact that we embody it, is an important truth. So how do you use that? How do you gain that? Well, right now, it's the new truth is emerging primarily in the form of philosophy. And there are a whole variety of integral philosophy books that can be read. And so you've got to read the books, right? I mean, you can go and browse around on blogs. There are many audio recordings, such as this one, but many different conferences and podcasts and interview series, primarily audio interviews. So there's ways to listen to and learn about integral philosophy from the various luminaries who are espousing it that don't involve reading the books. But reading the books is going to the heart of it, you know. And that's why I mentioned at the beginning Carter Phipps's new book Evolutionaries is good, because it's a good sort of easy entry point. It's a good way to understand. It's not just about integral philosophy, but integral philosophy has pride of place within the book, and it can help you appreciate where it's coming from and how it fits and how it can be distinguished from other forms of intellectual discourse which are using evolution as a foundation, such as postmodern types of evolutionary discourse and materialistic types of evolutionary discourse. You know, the singularity movement, as espoused by Ray Kurzweil, is very much about evolution, but it's not an integral philosophy. It's not using the new truths of integral. even though it's relying on evolution as a foundation for its, you know, intellectual overview. Likewise, many within the progressive spirituality movement who don't have this vertical dimension of the evolution of consciousness in their perspective, they still see things more horizontally. They nevertheless are using the terms evolutionary, right, and conscious evolution. And again, we're not opposed to them. We, you know, the people who have an integral perspective can appreciate the truths of all these different perspectives. But there's something about the integral perspective which transcends those, and they're, you know, it's hard to kind of boil down to a soundbite.
It sort of manages to be more inclusive of all these different levels of thinking.
I keep talking about verticality, and what I mean by that is instead of just seeing that there are some people who are countercultural and there's some people who are mainstream and there's some people who are traditional, as though we're types along a horizontal political spectrum of left and right, for example, right? We can begin to see that there's actually altitude in development, that is, some forms of consciousness are indeed more evolved, more developed, because they're more inclusive, right? Their understanding of what's true involves, you know, more. Their understanding of what's good draws the circle of moral concern, you know, with a wider So what makes it more evolved is that it's more true and more good and more beautiful. That doesn't mean that it's absolutely more true or good or beautiful. Indeed, every new evolutionary emergence brings with it new problems, right? New pathologies that require still further evolution, right? And that's part of the understanding, too, is it's not just an upward escalator to the good or an overly linear conception. You know, when you talk about verticality, you think about a plumb line, right? You think about a linear sense of what's vertical. And so we've got to be very nuanced. We've got to hold on to these concepts with subtlety, so that we don't get pulled into thinking about it too simplistically, but we can still use some of the core truths. I mean, it's like a polarity. On the one hand, we want to avoid one side, which is thinking about this as a linear, simple kind of clunk and grind system of better on the top, lower on the bottom. That's not what we're arguing for. On the other hand, you can be so nuanced and so defensive and so, pluralistically spread out that you can't really say anything definitive, right? And, you know, you can't really make any judgments about comparative excellence. You know, you become awash in a kind of a value relativism, you know, which ultimately becomes another form of absolutism. So we want to try to navigate between
these sides.
Which seems
so much of the sort of weakness, if you will, of sort of the modernist or maybe even postmodernist viewpoints, that they weren't able to include a broader expanse.
Well, we can have sympathy for these viewpoints and see what they have indeed accomplished without invalidating them or trying to vanquish them, right? Or it's,
well,
you know, saying, you know, modernism is dead and it's wrongheaded and we need to get rid of it and go back to whatever. I mean,
right.
That's the kind of thinking we're trying to transcend.
Right,
you know, we're trying to understand that every one of these stages has important things we need to keep and move forward with.
Well, I remember in our discussion last spring, you were reading a pretty heady book by, I think it was Deakin, and you were talking about how there's sort of an inevitable credibility crisis when you're looking at materialist metaphysics.
Mm-hmm.
And that this assertion that consciousness or value has to just be physical, and that the emergent view or the integral view is that it doesn't have to just be physical. It actually must also be spiritual in order to sort of free itself from that the confines of a purely materialistic thinking mechanism.
Could it be truly integral if it wasn't? If it didn't?
Well, I mean, you know, the Crystalline brings up an important topic, which at least let me touch on for, you know, 2 minutes, and that is a book that came out in the spring by Berkeley biologist Terence Deakin. It's called Incomplete Nature. And Deakin's a major genius. He's got huge intellectual horsepower. And in the book, he argues for a more detailed understanding of emergence itself, right? Which is one of the things that is a key element of the argument that evolution is more than just simply, you know, materialistic reactions that can be reduced to physics. Deakin does a pretty heroic job of trying to show how emergence is using all these different layers and levels of systemic, you know, self-organization that kind of is like a hydrofoil coming out of the, you know, when a boat gets fast enough and it has the hydrofoil dynamics, it's sort of a higher level just kind of emerges at a particular speed. And so he's trying to argue that emergence, the phenomenon of emergence, like the emergence of life or the emergence of human consciousness, the emergence of a vertebrate, the emergence of a neuron, you know, any level of emergence, that something creatively, something more has come from something less. Deakin explains it in materialistic terms, even while he laments the fact that a kind of a purely materialistic Richard Dawkins-style conception of neo-Darwinism is woefully outmoded, and he even identifies the tacit commitment to materialist metaphysics that he and his colleagues share can be a stumbling block in their ability to see things. So,
right.
Yeah, Deakin's a heroic character in his own way, but as I argue, he's still wedded to materialist metaphysics, even though he can see them. He still has to, mm-hmm. in a way, find a way to explain things in a purely material way where there's nothing but material causation that's responsible for everything. And I ultimately think he fails at that, despite, you know, this elaborate book that he's recently written.
So where would you see then the place for personal prayer and personal worship alongside integral philosophy? How does that act as a helpmate to, or how to, you know, how do both help each other?
Yeah.
Would be my question.
Sure. Well, first of all, you know, I think that there are, of course, many types of prayer and worship, but prayer and worship as categories, I think it's fair to say, are most generally associated with a theistic or panentheistic belief system or orientation to the universe, right? The fact that if you're praying and you're worshiping, that implies a deity or some kind of, you know, even creative principle, you know, most likely a kind of a personal loving creative principle or God, which is behind the universe and indeed inside of us. That's a frame which not everyone who has a spiritual orientation or who uses integral philosophy shares, right? There's, of course, a big camp of non-dualists who is mm-hmm. based on who take their conceptions of the ultimate either from you know, forms of Tibetan Buddhism or from Advaita Vedanta Hinduism, and there the focus of spiritual practice is more on meditation. And so prayer and worship, while again within the pluralistic culture of progressive spirituality, a lot of these terms are kind of mixed and matched, and you know, you might have, you know, non-dual forms of prayer or theistic meditation. You know, I mean, we can't draw strict lines between any of these. But having said that, those of us who do have a conception of a loving creator, as I do, can find that there's a deep form of spiritual practice that comes in the form of prayer and worship. And, of course, worship is really, I think, our first duty, as it's been said. And I think that these forms of spiritual practice, while they can be useful in deepening our spiritual relationship to the ultimate, at every level, right? They emerge from a traditional stage of consciousness. You know, they are carried forward. There are, you know, prayer and worship as a spiritual practice, it can be understood as a kind of a line of development, whereby there's different forms of prayer as our consciousness evolves and we have a more kind of robust understanding of spirit. Then I think what goes with that is the evolution of our prayer and worship. Right. In other words, our prayer isn't selfish. Our prayer isn't expecting, you know, the overcoming of natural laws.
Not like a letter to Santa.
right. But indeed, I think that these forms of traditional spiritual practice can find an authentic place within an evolutionary worldview. I'm incorporating that into my worldview, even as I transcend a traditional understanding of you know, the ultimate reality.
Well, you said earlier you talked quite a bit about spiritual growth. What in your opinion, Steve, are the earmarks of that?
Well,
how can a person look
at
their spiritual growth and say, you know what, I've really grown spiritually, or I have self-actualized. You know, I mean, I know that's would be hard to define, but I'd love to hear your opinion on that.
Yeah, and so that's an excellent question, and I appreciate it, and I have an answer. But as a preface, let me just say that I'm not holding myself out in the marketplace of ideas as a spiritual teacher per se. You know, I have a philosophy that I'm arguing for, which is a spiritual
mm-hmm.
philosophy, and of course
mm-hmm.
makes spiritual claims, but I try not to make those claims merely assertions or, you know, proclamations of a belief system. I try not to be evangelical about this.
Mm-hmm.
I want to argue for a spiritual philosophy that it can be inclusive of many different perspectives and not ones that necessarily can be associated with, a theistic perspective.
Mm.
And so, you know, what I'm about to say about spiritual growth is, you know, kind of a secondary element of the main thrust that I'm making. So,
And I'd like you to also go back and tell us why that is after you tell us this.
Okay. Well, ask me that again fresh after, because,
okay.
Many thoughts in my mind at once. First of all, I think that what I've found, one of the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth that among many of his great sayings and doings, which are usable as spiritual guides and practicable truths, one of the most potent is his saying that by their fruits you shall know them. And this, I found, for me, is a perfect way to evaluate any form of spiritual teaching, any philosophy, anything that involves truth and that partakes of a transcendent dimension. Can be evaluated, and it can be, this is relates back to what I said earlier regarding how this new understanding of evolution can act as a way of sorting out and providing a way of having comparative excellence even within, a pluralistic agreement about different forms of spirituality. And that the idea that by their fruits you shall know them helps us understand that that spiritual teachings are true to the extent that they make the world a better place. They're true to the extent that they're good. And I don't mean
mm-hmm.
that we need to have a kind of a very crude and short-term analysis. Sometimes the most beautiful flowers take a long time, to bloom. But I think one of the ways that we can tell whether we're growing spiritually is whether we're of greater use to our fellows in bringing the beautiful, the true, and the good into the world. If we understand that the purpose of evolution is for the creatures of evolution themselves to discern that which is true and beautiful and good, and to make to carry forward evolution's progressive advance by making this world, while we're here, a little bit better, and by having that effort to make the world a better place tied in to our own spiritual development. These things go hand in hand, right? In other words, we become more evolved, and the world becomes more evolved, as we give our gift, as we live up to our potential, to bring our particular version of what's beautiful, true, or good into the world. And this can be, grand practical schemes like feeding children in Africa, or it can simply be something like writing a book that people find inspiration from, or it can be multiple forms of service or artistic expressions or, teachings that help bring what's real, which help, bring the presence of the infinite into the finite. So, I guess what we can tell is, are we doing good? Are we giving our gift? Are people being benefited by our lives? That's one of the rock-solid ways we can tell. Even though, for example, the great spiritual teacher, for example, Ramana Maharshi, spent years, I hear, in a cave, right, before he eventually came out and became a teacher. So it doesn't necessarily need to occur day by day, right? Sometimes there's a time to invest in yourself. Sometimes there's
mm-hmm.
a time to invest in others. But ultimately, fulfilling our purpose in life, I think, if we want to live up to our spiritual potential, it means giving a gift to others and being of service in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the ways we can tell if we're spiritually growing.
I love that. I have there's a guy that I see every time I go to King Soopers here, which is the grocery store next to my house, not far from my house. His name is Paul. He was in a very bad accident when he was about 18, and it mentally diminished him. And yet, this man is the most kind and loving man I've ever met, and he's truly a goodwill ambassador. He'll come up to you and he'll greet you every day with something sweet and positive. He's so openly friendly and loving. And everybody in that store that walks in or works there knows him by name. And, you know, he will so graciously walk you out to your car and take your groceries and engage you in a conversation. And, you know, he's just a remarkable human being. And, you know, so you could say even somebody like Paul, who isn't capable probably of understanding advanced concepts of philosophy or spirituality or science or anything like that, can still change the world every day just by being a good person.
Yeah, and sometimes the things which seemed like the greatest tragedies to have afflicted us, like having brain damage from an accident,
right,
can in some, you know, like a miraculous way, result in the foundation of our very gift.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's kind of an analogy for our lives here on Earth. I mean, we're all there's no getting out of life without being wounded in some way, and the very tribulations and suffering that we experience on this planet, if we have a concept of an afterlife, can be understood to be, in a sense, not only the inventory of our comparative joy in the next life, but also an important foundation for the service that we can bring. So,
right.
You know, it says in the Arantia book, the greatest affliction is to have never been afflicted. And that's, you know, that's a great nugget that helps us appreciate, in a sense, why we live in a finite, partial universe in the first place, and how the finite can contribute to the infinite.
So I think that's an excellent point, yeah.
Yeah, I do too.
Indeed.
You were going to remind him to back up. And
well, yeah, just to, you were saying how you don't want to evangelize this. You don't want to impose these ideas, but you want to engage in the conversation. And I wanted you to back up and explain some of the reasons why you choose not to be evangelical.
Right, and I mean, I guess there's many ways to come at that. I mean, one is I certainly am an enthusiastic advocate of integral philosophy, right? I'm doing
right.
mine in the middle of my book tour, right? I've got a publisher.
Right.
We're trying to get the ideas out there and hope people respond to them. And so to that extent, I'm certainly evangelistic about this evolutionary worldview. But when it comes to my personal spiritual convictions, right, my particular take on what's spiritually real, I want to do my best to try to keep that somewhat separate from the philosophy, because the philosophy is going to do its best work. It's going to be most valuable if it is, you know, not a form of spiritual belief system, if it's not making claims of spiritual authority that may be difficult for people to accept. I mean, because it is a philosophy, because it's, you know, it connects to spiritual truths, but it also has a foundation of what science can show us and what history
mm-hmm.
has revealed to us. And you know, what I'm trying to do is help this evolutionary worldview emerge through the primary value that it has right now, which is this new truth, this deeper understanding of evolution. And what makes this thing true, what, you know, a huge power of the truth of it, is that it is free from spiritual belief systems. You know, it's not associated specifically with Advaita Vedanta or with Christianity or with any of the various forms of spiritual explanation. It's trying to show, okay, well, you know, we have a 14 billion year old universe, and we have this chain of emergence, and it's been a prolific generator of value, and we can feel it within us, and we are called to try to make the world a better place. And this is a philosophical frame that, while accommodating different understandings of spirit, doesn't require one. I mean, indeed, Stuart Kaufman is one of the people I mentioned as having influenced me, and he's a complexity scientist. He's written many books. He's a public intellectual. He's known as one of the founders of the Santa Fe Institute on system science. Now, he's got a great book called Reinventing the Sacred, which came out a couple of years ago.
Right, I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and he is, in a sense, you know, he was coming from a scientific materialist perspective, but saying, look, the creativity of the universe shows that we have to have a sacred dimension, right? We have to recognize that even if we have the most minimal spirituality possible, there's still no denying the creativity, and that can give us a sense of spirituality, which is as natural as it can be, right? And without being purely material. So I want to be able to render and explain integral philosophy in a way that can even appeal to somebody like Kaufman, while also being relevant to people who have a robust spiritual understanding of a loving creator and a theistic conception of the ultimate. So I think it's possible to bridge that gap between the most minimal and the most, I keep saying robust, but that's probably the best word for it, forms of spiritual belief through a philosophy that can take what science has shown us and begin to give us some orientation as to what the larger meaning and purpose of evolution is.
One of the things you say in your book is ultimately the authentic experience of goodness, truth, or beauty is a spiritual experience, which sort of gives us that taste of unity.
Mm-hmm.
And that fleeting glimpse of unity includes the unity of time in the present. And I'm extrapolating that also, you know, all the different things that have come from the past, wherein future potentials can be sort of palpably felt. You know, we sort of innately sense that there's more coming. There's more to grow to.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that we just know as an evolving being.
Let me just pick up on that point. In the book tour that I've been on for the past few weeks, at several of my talks, one of the things that's come up, you know, in the question period is what is value? You know, what are we talking about? For example, Howard Gardner, who is one of the colleagues of Robert Keegan at the Harvard's Educational Department, Graduate Education, he's written a book on truth, beauty, and goodness, he calls it. And he's coming from a completely secular point of view. This book came out, you know, about a year and a half. And Gardner analyzes beauty, truth, and goodness. Although he's fascinated by it, he wants to flatten it, right? There's no spiritual or transcendent dimension in it. I mean, he's not arguing as a polemic atheist by any stretch. He's sort of just a humanist and a secularist. And the fact that you could write a whole book about the beautiful, the true, and the good and not really understand that we're talking about, you know, the comprehensible elements of deity, you know, is an interesting thing. You know, I mean, it was an interesting exercise. And, you know, one of the things he says, you know, that truth and beauty, for example, can't be conflated. You know, despite Yeats's poem about, you know, beauty is truth and truth is beauty and that's all you need to know, Gardner makes a point, well, look, I mean, sometimes the truth can be exceedingly ugly, right? And indeed, you know, that's one of the purposes of truth, is to bring the ugliness and suffering in the world into our faces so we can, you know, deal with it and not ignore it. Right, and sometimes beauty or fashion can be very much about deceit, right, or an illusion. And so, you know, he's making a good point that these values are not simply these kind of lofty ideals that we as religionists often describe them as. And the way we can kind of reconcile those two views is to understand these values as directions, approaches to the perfect. And they reach all the way down to the ground. And so if we think of them as sort of a spectrum, you know, from the highest, you know, from the most transcendent to, you know, the most material, at one end of the spectrum, they are very distinct. You know, when beauty is in its most superficial, right, it's hardly true or maybe even not very good, right? But at its highest, more spiritual level, it's somewhat indistinguishable from goodness and truth. They're all kind of working together. And so, you know, I don't want to be too structural in this description, but if we think of these as trajectories that point to or lead to a transcendent dimension, you know, that we can look at them in any place along that spectrum and see them as, you know, fact or as meaning or as a transcendent form of value, and understanding that they're directions of improvement rather than things. It's very hard to train your mind. It's a philosophical exercise indeed. You know, this development of this perspective, to begin to understand what values are and not fall into this sort of expectation that we have that we want to make them either object or subject.
Mm-hmm.
We want to say that they're either Platonic essences, right, and have a pre-modern conception of what the values are, or we want to just have an existential perspective and say there's no There's no dynamic quality in the world that exists apart from our perspective, that it's all subjective. You know, it's not just beauty that's in the eye of the beholder, it's also truth and goodness, and that we just project these preferences on the world. They don't have any reality apart from our subjective awareness. And so, you know, that those are the sort of the horns of the mistake, right? You know, you either go too far and try to find them objectively and they're not there, or you try to reduce them to, you know, subjective, and that creates problems too, which I address in my book. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that I can really land in an interview like this, mm-hmm. but it is something that I take very seriously, and describe coming up with a theory of value that can recognize how it has objective elements, but it's not simply objective. It has a subjective requirement, but it can't be reduced to the subjective. This is a very meaty and important philosophical point, especially given the time of history we're in, wherein the idea of transcendent value is certainly not accepted by the majority of mainstream thinkers.
So we have a caller. Can we take a call? This person.
Hey,
might
you're the
just
boss.
Be listening. we'll just see what. Area code 780. You're with us on the Cosmic Citizen.
Yes, it's Jay Kong from Canada.
Hi.
Hi, Jay.
Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you much. It's interesting. It's been a day of actually evolution, I think, for some other shows. interesting show regarding evolution. I just wondered the process that we're in right now is. As I think we're all feeling in some way or another. I just wondered, has this occurred before in other cycles of Earth cycles where evolution has actually, we've evolved to a certain point and then we go back down to again to maybe a level of, you know, not knowing anything or not waking up or anything like that. Did you discover that or investigate that?
I mean, if you're talking about regressions in history, you know, in other words, the evolution of culture can move backward. It can de-evolve to simpler, less complex stages. We can certainly see that occurring in history with the fall of empires, right? I mean, the European Dark Ages, you know, is Exhibit A for the possibility of cultural regression, or even some of the horrors of the 20th century, right? We can see how modernity can go awry and create, you know, horrific suffering and destruction. So, you know, an important element of being able to argue for coherently and reclaim this vertical dimension of development that we've been discussing, and how we can recognize that there are indeed forms of consciousness and culture that are more evolved than others, is by seeing that part of the process is it's dialectical in its development, meaning that there's a clear pattern of thesis, antithesis, or synthesis, or as Hegel put it, affirmation, negation, and then negation of the negation, right? So anyway, that's kind of philosophically technical, and I take pains to explain it as clearly as possible in the book. But this pattern of what cultural evolution is about is trying to improve conditions, right? Where humans are trying to make their lives better, and that's what causes cultural evolution. That's what drives it forward. And what's better is sometimes only seen in contrast to what's wrong. Right, so our opportunities to make the world a better place, in a sense, are directly related to the problems we face on the ground, the problematic life conditions that we're encountering in our time in history. So as we move away from what's wrong, in a sense, that creates a heading which has within it a latent potential of another different kind of wrong. In other words, if there's too much competition and there's too much harsh individuality, then moving to a greater stage of cooperation is clearly the way forward. But if you go too far in the direction of embracing cooperation at the expense of competition, if the community is emphasized over the individual, so much so that it becomes stifling and oppressive, and you're in a conformist kind of a culture where, you know, their individual expressions can be difficult, that's another kind of pathology that then requires that sort of defines the direction of improvement, you know, as an opposite. And so we can see in history that there's this sort of tacking back and forth like a sailboat, right? A sailboat can't sail directly into the wind. It has to kind of advance obliquely and turn back and forth, right? And that's kind
of a great analogy.
The pattern in culture that we can see. Now, sometimes, you know, to risk taking the analogy too far, the boat can get wrecked on the shore and then you have to sort of start again with a new direction. And so, you know, there are many in the culture now, many voices who claim the imminent collapse of our civilization, right? Either through climate change or nuclear proliferation, or you know, the ravages of unsustainable economic development. I mean, there's plenty of doomsday scenarios, and you know, those risks are, you know, do really threaten us. I don't think anyone can say for sure what's going to happen in the future, but I mean, we can see in the 20th century, you know, the horrific damage that had occurred to modernity as a result of World War II, and yet, you know, things were resilient, and civilization did not collapse despite however many millions dead and how many cities laid waste. I think that that these challenges that we're facing that I mentioned are going to require some breakthroughs, not only in technology, but in cultural agreement and solidarity and compassion. I think it's a challenging century we're entering into. But I also have a faith in evolution itself, a faith that partially evolution is stimulated by the severity of the problems. And as problems get worse, the pressure for evolution gets worse too. Now, you know, the
necessity
problems can be so
being the mother of invention.
Right. But these same pressures can also cause regression, as we can see in the historical record as well. And whether we respond by regressing or by progressing, you know, is still an open question at this point.
Well, indeed. And it seems to beg the question as to, you know, if we assume that reality is somehow self-aware, you know, in a philosophical perspective, you know, what are the means by which, you know, this reality is able to avoid retrogressions, or put more positively, to foster its own self-progression versus, you know, fall into traps of regression? And it begs another question for me as well, which is, you know, how much are we on our own? How much am I entirely on my own resources and entirely independent of not only just anybody else that I can come in contact with, but what is the real nature of the universe? How much support do I have for my existence?
Right. Well, I mean, those are important and large questions that I can't take the position of an all-knowing guru and just kind of answer those definitively and in a satisfying way. But I can say that that part of the way we avoid regression is through the heroic action by the skin of our teeth, right? Like we did in World War II. I mean, we just you know, we didn't, you know, beat the forces of fascism. You know, it was a close-run thing for a long time, and it was only by you know, a certain amount of genius, a certain amount of luck, a certain amount of dedication by many, many people, not just by, you know, the great minds or luminaries of the time, but also by the average person, right, is how we pulled through out of that crisis and didn't allow the world to sink into, you know, oppression and slavery as would have occurred if fascism had won. And so that's how partially we're going to do it, is by the skin of our teeth, by all of us really doing everything we can and taking responsibility for these problems, and by doing our very best to strive for a world that works for everyone, and to keep in mind that we live, as long as we're alive, for the rest of our lives on this planet, we're going to live in a world of trouble and suffering. And it's our duty to do everything we can in our own small way, you know, even our own big way, to make the world a better place. And that's why I'm in integral philosophy in the first place, is that it does really have the promise to create a lot of progress, to create a lot of social healing, a lot of spiritual leadership, higher forms of agreement, new philosophical technologies that can solve problems of consciousness. And so, you know, I mean, there's more to go there. Regarding the other question of, you know, what's behind all this, you know, that's where I think our spiritual convictions, you know, the forms of spiritual teaching that inspire us, that we're drawn to, you know, the answers, you know, for those questions are that's one of the things that spirituality is good for, is by describing the meaning of the self, the nature of the ultimate, the purpose of our lives, you know, the big questions. And while philosophy can go you know, in that direction, ultimately, you know, to take it all the way, to really provide the kind of satisfactory answer to the question you're asking, it requires a form of faith, a form of conviction of a higher spirituality that can't be seen. You know, I love the quote from Pascal, where he says that human things must be known in order to be loved, but divine things must be loved in order to be known. And that is a sort of a clue as to how, you know, this faith or this spiritual understanding of ultimate reality is something to be practiced and can't just be simply possessed.
Well, and here's a thought, and what you're saying just brings this to me so clearly. You know, we talk about events in world history and how they might have been different, and you think about, you know, I speculate often. I wonder what it would have been like if, say, they hadn't crucified Jesus, or, you know, I mean, you can just take any world event and speculate about it. And it's kind of like life in a way. You know, you have a collectively we have choices and we act on those choices. And even individually we have choices and we act on those choices. And oftentimes it doesn't matter what choice we make. It's an uphill battle no matter what choice it is. And every choice we make is going to be fraught with difficulty and rewards. And, you know, evolution is the master, if we let it, of taking those difficulties and turning them into rewards. And it's not about how we get there, it's about what we learn on the journey. And, you know, I have faith, and speaking of faith, and I know all of you do on this call, have faith that all things work together for good, and that we are going to get there. We are going to reach our evolutionary destiny. No matter what might happen in the meantime, even if we get into the interregnum of you know, the dark, like something like the Dark Ages, the interregnum of wisdom, where we regress, we move back down the spiral a bit or whatever, that's just a delay. In my opinion, that's just a delay in the inevitable. We will reach our destination because everything in the universe shows that it's set up for that to occur, for that growth to happen. But you know, you had said earlier, Steve, that one of the things that you know, really hold is this hope. And one of the things that spiral dynamics and the integral philosophy holds is this hope for the world. And in this objectivity, you understand how we have to go through these stages and that we will get there. Can you expound on that a little bit? I mean, or did I just say it, essentially?
Well, let me just say that was beautifully put, and I couldn't agree more, and right on, sister. You know? but I could just add that that I think that if we care, you know, that we haven't given up. We're not just sort of gone completely to the pole of pessimism. And I mean, you know, for example, James Lovelock, who was a famous scientist who sort of came up with the idea of Gaia, and he's got great respect within the scientific establishment, you know, has recently sort of indulged in these sort of environmental doomsaying, like, you know, it's too late, we're past the tipping point, the human race is going to be extinct. And, of course, you know, that's a great technique for getting media, and he certainly got a lot of it as a result of that. But I think that if we do care and we do actually want to contribute to avoiding regression and making the world a better place, a very important part of it is having the moral courage to have the kind of hope you just described, right? That even, you know, even if we are in for a rough ride, even if we, you know, there is going to be major trouble ahead, that will just be, you know, part of the structure that makes us more stable in our higher stages in the future, even if we're not alive to see it. And I think that having that moral courage and having that long-term perspective and realizing that, you know, everything does work together for good, and that you know, that even if it's temporarily lost, it's not lost forever, and it is recorded at a kind of a higher level, in some kind of a morphic field or Akashic record or who knows what. But I do think that it's kind of like our duty, like our political duty to vote. You know, it's our cultural duty to have a bit of moral courage and not be blind optimists and not be oblivious to or try to deny or explain away the threats that face us, but to have an expectation that all is not lost and that indeed we can make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We need to reintroduce our guest and let our listeners know we're talking with Steve McIntosh this morning about his new book, The Purpose of Evolution. and we are taking callers after the first hour, and the phone number here is 646-716-8158. Thanks for your patience. Those who are still holding on and those who've had to hang up, sorry. I've got a question from one who had to hang up, and he wanted to know, is science promoting secularism, and why are people in the scientific field afraid of God?
Well, that's a good question. I think that science in its, you know, first of all, there's a sort of myth of science as pure science, right? Like that science isn't involved with questions of what's real or what's true or whether there are values or there are things that are beyond science. I mean, while that's true to a degree, and we could certainly identify elements of, you know, scientists doing pure research that doesn't have any, you know, philosophical implications, there is a institutional culture of science. Right, if you pick up Scientific American magazine, right, or you know, go to many of these science websites, it's unmistakable the culture of scientific materialism. Again, that's not science itself; it's a philosophy, it's a culture, it's a metaphysical reality frame, you know, that says that the world is simply material, and you know, it's woven together with the thinking of many scientists. I think at this time in history, for many, especially the field of evolution, it provides a kind of theoretical handcuffs, right, that keeps us from getting at the larger truths of what science is trying to understand. But I don't think that every scientist is a materialist, or that science itself, in the majority of its enterprises, is trying to be anti-spiritual or compete with more spiritual forms of philosophy. I mean, science has brought us great accomplishments and continues to do so, and I'm very pro-science, for sure. What I try to do in Evolution's Purpose, in my book, is show that within the science of evolution, there's no way to talk about or understand the evolution of the universe, especially, you know, from a high, sort of other than a very small resolution. I mean, if you're looking at a very narrow window of evolution, you may be able to do science just fine without any kind of philosophical attachments or commitments or complications. But when we look at biology, when we look at cosmology, when we look at the bigger picture of evolution, what's now gaining ground as what's called big history, right, that there's no way to extract a philosophy from it. There's a philosophy attached to it no matter what you do. And so what I'm attempting to do, and others within integral philosophy are attempting to do to a degree, is to make this philosophy more explicit, to show how it even though it's inevitable, even though as soon as you get rid of one kind of philosophy or you try to improve on the philosophy, you need another philosophy to improve it. What I'm trying to do is show how the scientific facts themselves really are better contained and explained and contextualized within a philosophy that can recognize progress and purpose, within a philosophy that can see how evolution is a generator of value, and that evaluation is an important technique of perception. Indeed, we can't understand evolution unless we can allow ourselves to evaluate it. And scientists evaluate it when they work with it, really, no matter what they do. And so trying to make that part, the evaluation part, the philosophical part, the metaphysical part, to make that more well-developed, to help advances there match the staggering advances that have been made, you know, on the physical side of the science,
right.
You know, even while the philosophical side is still stuck in a kind of a Victorian notion of pure materialism.
Right. Why do you think science has a problem with the concept of mind as an organic property as opposed to sort of a supermaterial property?
Well, it's a complex cultural situation. Part of it is that the transition from a traditional to modernist, you know, again, those are defined terms within integral discourse, but the pre-modern mythic worldview, the religious-based worldview versus the sort of scientific rational worldview, that's still an emergence, which is ongoing. I mean, even though it first emerged during the Enlightenment, the majority of the world still makes meaning from a pre-modern perspective. And indeed, scientists within the public education system in the United States are still fighting to being able to talk about evolution from a scientific perspective without having to negotiate with creationists and a mythic reality frame. So there's still much of science is still kind of fighting the good fight to help people evolve beyond a superstitious or mythical perception of reality, right? And so when they poll the United States and a huge number say they don't believe in evolution, the Kansas School Board is still passing these, saying that intelligent design or creationism needs to be taught in the schools, that's a battlefront. That's a line where many of these scientists and indeed the rise of the new atheists as a belief system, as a form of anti-spirituality. Is in response to this important battlefront that's still going on within history of moving people from the traditional to the modernist perception. But of course, every one of these stages, whether it's traditional, modernist, postmodern, they all have zealots. They all have fundamentalists within their ranks. So just like not every evangelical Christian is a fundamentalist Christian. Mm-hmm. Not every scientist is a scientific materialist or an atheist, right? Mm-hmm. But scientific materialism and militant atheism is a form of fundamentalism, even though it's coming from a modernist perspective. I mean, there's a lot more to say about that, but, that's probably a good place to stop.
Do we have any callers waiting, Paula?
No, and I would encourage the caller from Florida to call back in, please. We typically take callers in the second hour to give our guests a chance to really develop, the point of view and the interview. So don't get discouraged. Please do give us a call back. The number is 646-716-8158. We will get you on. Actually, our caller 780 from Canada is still on with us. Did you have anything else that you wanted to ask Steve, caller?
Jay.
Thanks, Jay.
Yes. Yes, I do, actually. I just wondered, you're talking about the evolutionary process and also the scientific community not moving on the old ways of thinking, but there's a lot of evidence out there that past civilizations were more advanced than us. Like, there's lots of figures, like pyramids and buried pyramids and artifacts. Just why is that all buried underneath a mound somewhere or in a vault somewhere that we don't even know about? And it's the powers that be know that it's there, but why is this happening?
Yeah. Well, I certainly think that as we understand these stages of evolutionary development, that one of the things that happens is that there are gains that are lost along the way. And one of the opportunities that we have with this evolutionary perspective is to begin to reclaim some of the wisdom that's been lost from the past. I'll come back to the whether there's lost civilizations that were more advanced than us. I'll comment on that in a moment. But let me make this larger and more important point, I think, that one of the projects of the evolutionary worldview as it becomes more culturally prominent and begins to grow in its demographical reach is to begin to reach back and celebrate and incorporate some of the values of traditional consciousness that have been lost and some of the values of modernism that are still, in a sense, rejected by a progressive culture of postmodernism. We can see postmodernism itself doing this to a degree in its celebration of tribal culture. Like, for example, if you go to Burning Man, which is very postmodern in its center of gravity, you'll see that much of the aesthetic and much of the vibe at Burning Man is this kind of tribal celebration. And even though postmodernism romanticizes, tribal aesthetics, tribal spirituality, tribal entheogenic practices, that it nevertheless is doing, it's beginning the job of reaching back into history and reclaiming, some of the great elements of the cultures of the past that have been lost. And indeed, there's many elements of wisdom that we can attribute to the tribal, even as we have a kind of a romantic view of it. And part of the way we're able to do that is that tribal culture is so rare. There's so few remnants of authentic tribal culture left in the world that we're not threatened by it. And we can begin to celebrate it and reclaim it more easily, you know, because we're not about to be, you know, ambushed by, you know, tribal warriors on the prairie here. We can sort of see that that is a beautiful form of human development that we want to reclaim. Now, when it comes to traditional spirituality or traditional culture, you know, that's something we are still threatened by. You know, is a traditional stage of consciousness that just burned down our embassy and assassinated our ambassador, right? So it's the threats of that form of culture are still there, and so it's a more difficult task to try to begin to reclaim and celebrate the enduring and important parts of those cultural developments. But that's one of the things that Integral can allow us to do. We can start to tease apart the dignities from the disasters, if you will, you know, the enduring permanent values that we need going forward from the pathologies that are closely woven together with those very advances. And so that's, I mean, I could go on making that point, but
well,
hopefully that explains. Now, just in terms of past civilizations, you know, there's a huge industry of conspiracy theorists and kind of New Age describers of lost civilizations, and I view those largely, you know, with a kind of a dubious eye. I think that I'm fairly a conventional archaeology guy when it comes to understanding what the what conventional understandings of history have uncovered. Although there's still more, and then we I think we are amazed to find advances that are you know, like the beautiful art of the paintings, you know, the cave paintings that are 40,000 years old. I mean, there's clearly insights from the past, and we don't want to look at them as simply, you know, ignorant. But in terms of more advanced, I mean, I don't think there's ever been a global civilization like we've had before. You know, there's never been 747s flying around or an internet or, you know, iPhones or any of the amazing technologies we have. Neither has there ever been a cross-pollinization of wisdom. Neither has all the wisdom of all the world's religions been available to us, you know, with the simple mm-hmm. click of a mouse. Neither has there mm-hmm. been, you know, the human genome decoded, and, you know, I mean, the Higgs boson discovered, and the, you mm-hmm. know, the origins of time and space understood. I mean, there's never been a civilization like this. And I think that you know, that I'm in good company in that conclusion in terms of people of good sense and good faith. And that doesn't mean that we won't continue to discover amazing things of the past, but the idea that we've fallen from some higher stage, I think, is a myth.
Okay, well, we have another caller on with us right now. And thanks, Jay, from Canada. I really appreciated your input. And area code 239, I believe Florida, is with us now on the Cosmic Citizen.
Hi, everybody. I'm really enjoying the show. I think Stephen's points are just right on. I've been listening for the last half an hour. And, of course, with everything that you said, I have 10 questions, but I'll try to whittle it down to two. First of all, I would take it that you're more of a pragmatist in the way that you view reality. And I don't know who came up with it, but, you know, recently I've sort of adopted a policy where if you look at reality from simply a scientific point of view, it's like looking at reality with one of your eyes closed. And then unless you take the spiritual part of that, which is where we get the meanings and the values, and I'll give you an example. Science can explain what the chemical properties are to a rose, but the spiritual component is when we can look at a rose and say, that is a beautiful object. And that's what I think is missing from much of what is coming out of, or at least in the media, what's coming out of the scientific community. For example, you touched on it. You know, from the scientific point of view, we look at the mind as being an organic part of a physical organ, but the mind is, if that was true, then every mind would in fact act the same way, just like a machine. So what do you think, maybe the better way to ask this question is this, do you think that the reason perhaps there is a rise in antidepressant drugs, alcoholism, all of the different factors, depression, do you think that part of that is because of the secularism that has come about in the last 200 years? And what is it that the ultimate debate between creationism, which says there's a reason we're here, and then the scientific explains the how. To me, creationism is the why, and evolution is the how, or the science is the how. What are your comments on, and I know I asked four different questions, but try as you best. And if you're ever in Florida, I'd love to have a cup of coffee with you. I think it'd be great.
By the way, caller, can you just give us a first name?
Oh, Jim.
Jim. Great.
Hi, Jim.
Thanks for those questions and those thoughts. You know, I think that, as I mentioned earlier, I don't know whether you were on the first half, I don't know whether it was in the first half of the call, that it's possible for people of every stage or every cultural, you know, worldview to become self-actualized within that worldview. I mentioned, you know, Bill Gates as being perhaps a self-actualized modernist. And I think that it's possible for people who have a secular, materialistic worldview to become happy, to be, you know, to be fulfilled, to become even self-actualized. I don't think that, you know, that it's absolutely necessary for people to have a kind of a spiritual conviction that goes beyond this world, although I certainly think that you can't apprehend the, you know, the greater truths of what's real from that perspective, just like you can't apprehend the greater truths from a tribal perspective or a traditional perspective, right? We're talking about evolution in terms of things getting more inclusive. And so if your worldview rules out the reality of values or the nature of spirit, then that clearly doesn't include an aspect of reality that many of us can agree does in fact exist. And so when it comes to depression and alcoholism, you know, we might attribute it to, you know, nihilism that results from the despair of not having a hope for a greater reality or an afterlife. But I think that's probably overstating the point, right? I think there are plenty of people who don't have a spiritual belief, who are not depressed, who, you know, who are not nihilistic, who don't, you know, who do just fine. So it's important to recognize that there are people of good sense and good faith who are healthy within their own perspectives, and that they don't need necessarily our frame of reality to make them whole or complete. You know, in other words, the Claire Graves, who is one of the luminaries of developmental psychology upon whom integral philosophy rests, is famous for the saying, you know, damn it all, people have a right to be who they are. You know, there's no imperative to evolve. And I think that's an important pole of what we're saying. You know, we're trying to promote evolution. We're trying to describe evolution. We're trying to reclaim a more moral conception of a vertical dimension of development that doesn't sort of fall into ethnocentric notions of cultural superiority. That's hard to do unless you're willing to recognize that everybody, you know, is okay no matter where they are in the evolution of consciousness. And that applies to secular modernists as well as to, you know, the more perhaps attractive indigenous cultures, you know, that we want to protect because they've been marginalized and exploited. You know, everybody deserves a right to be who they are. So that's the answer to the first question. You know, but I think that just to add one more thing, and that is, you know, depression, drug abuse, whatever, you know, that you can see that at every level of development. Some levels have it worse than others, but I don't think we can necessarily point to lack of spirituality as the sort of, you know, kind of easy cause and effect, you know, there.
If you're looking in terms of absolute truths, are there absolute truths that we can extrapolate from the argument that evolution is? Would you agree that evolution appears to be an intentional process, and does not intent sort of imply that there is a creative mind that's involved in that process? And if that is the case, can you extrapolate that there would be an absolute truth that spirituality is a real force in the universe?
I think that absolute can't be put together with truth. I think that to say that there's absolute truth is to say that there's sort of static objective truth. And the nature of truth as a direction of development, at least here on this planet, can never be made into an absolute, because it's always subject to further discovery, further development, further nuance, right? So we can't expect truths to behave like objects and stand still so that we can begin to claim them as being absolute. While we can have certainty, I think that I have certainty that I'm real, that I have certainty that, you know, that I'm not just projecting the world. I can have certainty in my own heart that spirit is real, and that you know, my job here is to grow spiritually and to give to others. Those are all certainties that I know from direct experience. But in terms of a kind of scientific style proof or kind of an absolute law that we can assert as simply, you know, given, I think that our philosophy has evolved beyond those expectations, because we can understand that what's true depends on our level of consciousness. And that doesn't mean that it's totally relative. What it means is that as consciousness develops, that which is true expands, so that truth is something that requires both an objective pole and a subjective pole, and as the subjective pole evolves, the objective pole evolves with it. It's what Henri Bergson described as the mobility of the real, right? So we may know at the evolutionary level these higher truths about the spiritual nature of the universe, but even those truths are subject to this dialectical trajectory in history, whereby we can anticipate, you know, an emergence in the future that'll partially push off against the problems of our understanding of what's true.
So in other words, we can never know for sure what we can't comprehend, basically.
Well, we can be certain in our own self, like I said, about certain spiritual truths, but we can't impose those on others in a way that compels them to believe it, like we can, gravity. Gravity is, in some ways, you know, even though that is something that we're going to be understanding more as we evolve our consciousness, you know, these scientific facts are something that one of the ways they gain traction in the culture is they are compelling, right? You really do have to kind of draw a circle around yourself of myth to hold out these scientific truths. But when it comes to spirit, I think one of the characteristics of natural signs of spirit is that they're both widely accessible and easily resistible. And what I mean by that is when it comes to something like, cosmic wonder or beneficial order or moral duty, you know, these signs of spirit, that even little children can experience them and recognize them, but they can always be explained away. They're never overawing so much that they force someone into believing in spirit or to acknowledging spirit. You know, it's, you know, atheists can always make the world safe for their worldview because these things are not they're not coercive, right? You know, the spirit reaches us. We have to agree. We have to allow it in. We have to invite it. And if the door is closed, spirit's not going to kick it down. And that's why we do well not to speak in terms of absolute truths, especially when it comes to spiritual realities.
Well, you're a very smart man, and I am going to buy your book, and I really appreciate a lot of what you've had to say today. I think it's good. I don't want to say mind candy, as if it doesn't have substance or vitamins in it, because my brain, I think, has grown a few centimeters since 12 o'clock today. So thank you for that.
Good. I hope you like the book. Thanks.
Thanks for calling, Jim. And you're invited to hang on here with us if you like. I'm going to put our good friend God's Gumshoe on. Hi, Gumshoe.
Hi. Hi, Paula. Hi, Chrislyn. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Steve, I have to say, I'm one of your biggest fans. I read all your books, all Carter Phipps books. I photocopy your material. I hand it out in all my classes, all my lectures. If I was still in the pulpit, I'd be preaching it from the pulpit. It's great stuff. I really think that you're really helping us to get an understanding of our world and how it works. I'm a longtime Urantia book reader, and if I could, I would be standing on the street corner passing this material out, except that there's already somebody on that street corner telling the world that it's coming to an end on December the 21st. So on December the 22nd, I suspect I'll be able to go and do that. I've got all your books, Steve, and I particularly like the idea of the progress of the integral perspective and the spiral dynamics. The image of the spiral is so profound. And what I particularly enjoyed is your vision of the governance of the future of development of world governments. I would really like to hear you sort of expound a little bit more on that, if we've got time and you've got a chance.
Sure, I think we have a couple minutes left.
We have 10 minutes, actually.
Yeah, and thank you very much for your kind words about my work. I'll try to live up to those expectations.
But when the lawyers come about this plagiarizing guy called Gumshoe, you'll know who it is.
Yeah, okay, no, I trust you'll be aware of my commercial needs while at the same time helping me spread the word. You know, I'm obviously not in this for the money. Let me try to answer your question about in my last book, which came out in 2007, Integral Consciousness and the Future of Evolution, I have a chapter on integral politics where I really make a strong case for the ideal of global governance, the idea of the political evolution toward a world federation. And since that book has come out, I've gotten some attention along those lines. What is Enlightenment magazine did an extensive interview of me where the focus was on my advocacy of world federalism. And I learned in the course of going out there with a book and talking about global governance that as a political perspective, even if we talk about this as something we need to evolve toward and not something we want to try to inaugurate now, it doesn't have legs, right? It doesn't. People don't get it. They don't like it. They reject it. It doesn't. It sort of flies right over their head. It takes someone who has already got either a firm spiritual teaching that they've had for a long time that makes them recognize this as something benign and inevitable and desirable and achievable. Or someone who already has their center of gravity within this evolutionary perspective, then they can appreciate world federalism a little bit more. But for those who are postmodern or modernist, the idea of global governance just seems either too radical or too idealistic, right? It's either too dangerous or too far in the future to care about now. And so I respect that. I mean, politics has got to be the art of the possible. And if you have an element of your teaching that just does not connect and doesn't have legs, if people are responding to and using and metabolizing, you know, the truth of other forms of what you've said, and but they're blocked in another, you know, you've got to pay attention to that. I want to serve, right? And I don't want to just bang my head against the wall. That doesn't mean I'm an entertainer or I just want to pander to what people want to hear. But at the same time, I also want to be responsive to what doesn't work. And what hasn't really worked very well is this advocacy of world federalism, despite the fact there are other, you know, many others, if you go online, who don't have an integral perspective per se, but who are nevertheless champions of world federalism. And so in Evolution's Purpose, in my latest book, at the last chapter that I mentioned, the last 45 pages or so, chapter 9, I have a segment called Integral Politics. And there what I've done is try to take the lessons of the failure of world federalism to be recognized as a good idea by the audience to say, look, integral politics has short-term goals and long-term goals, right? The short-term goals, like in the next maybe, you know, several decades, is to achieve this understanding of the evolutionary growth of culture and consciousness, to bring that more into the discourse in both domestic and international, you know, political affairs. That's one of the things that I'm doing. I'm founding a think tank along with Carter Phipps and Elizabeth DeBold and Michael Zimmerman and Andrew Cohen. We're forming a think tank that tries to apply integral perspectives to politics. Mm-hmm. You can see the website culturalevolution.org, where we have a placeholder webpage, and if you're interested, you can follow our progress there. We're going to be circulating some papers about climate change in the weeks ahead. But in Evolution's Purpose, to go back to world federalism, in the second half of this section on integral politics, I mentioned the long-term goals. Right. And there I try to acknowledge what I've learned about this, and that is that world federalism requires a level of consciousness that the world does not exhibit at the moment, right? Any political step forward is going to have, you know, problems and pathologies associated with it, right? Just like democracy, you know, the cliche from Winston Churchill, we've all heard it, right? Democracy is the worst possible system until you consider the rest. So, you know, I mean, you know, that is, democracy can actually, if the consciousness isn't ready for it, it can create more harm than good in certain circumstances, and so would a world federal structure, some kind of merger between the EU and the U.S., for example, or other developed nations kind of forming a more consolidated political pact. That mm-hmm. might make things worse, at least until the consciousness has evolved to the point where it can be responsible enough to handle the increased power that would come from that new level. And even this, I mean, I'm not talking about the vision of a world state. You know, we're talking about a limited pooling of sovereignty that preserves national structures and national identities, while at the same time creating some kind of global law that is democratically enacted and can help just to deal with the fact that we have a global economy and we have a global media, and we have a global culture in many ways, but we still don't have any kind of global law, and that's, you know, that's proceeding apace whether we like the idea of global law or not. increasingly the lack of any kind of global law is going to become a bigger and bigger problem as the world becomes globalized in other ways, right? So I do still advocate the ideal in the future of global governance and world federalism, but I'm trying to put forth a more nuanced position so people don't confuse it with something that's either too idealistic to be practical or too radical to be safe.
Well, I like the idea that the model of the European Union, once it evolves a little further on down the line, is a reasonably good model to have a look at rather than the United States of the world or something like that.
Sure. Yeah. We're not talking about the federal government of the United States writ large. And I mean, we could spend an hour and a half talking about the idea of world federalism, and it's important to anybody who's listening.
Maybe we should have a show about that sometime in the future.
Steve would be a good one to speak on.
Yeah, sometime in the far future. I just want to say that what we're talking about, you know, is just coming out here. To a degree, we're careful to address the concerns and to explain why, we're not trying to jump the gun with this, or we don't have this radical agenda.
Yeah, I think that it's coming from the Urantia book perspective that says that the ideal is one language, one law, one world government, really has Urantia book readers wondering, well, I wonder what that might look like. And when I read your possibilities in your first book on the evolution of the future of evolution, I really, really liked that idea it seemed to fit better than anything else that I've seen. And we're going to need to do something to have world government in order to sort of rein in this the corporate capitalism and the climate control. And I mean, without corporate law, we got around global law, we got global outlaws, and we really need to look at that. And I know that there are people who are doing that. And anyway, I like
very
your perspective.
Very complex issue.
Yes.
Sure. Yes, it is.
And
anyway,
we're down to our last 5 minutes.
Yeah. So I'll bail out and say goodbye. And thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Jim.
I'd like to just give
thanks, Gumshoe.
Thanks for calling in, Gumshoe, and thanks, Jim and Jay. For calling.
Yes.
And I'd like to just give Steve an opportunity to give a quick overview of a conclusion, wrap up the talk about his book, and also to remember to give our listeners a link to where they can get your book.
Sure. Well, the book is, of course, available on Amazon, and it's making its way into distribution in mainstream bookstores in the United States and elsewhere. You can also be purchased with free shipping on my website, stevemcintosh.com, stevemcintosh.com. And that website includes excerpts, video segments, a blog. I mean, there's a lot to it where you can read around without having to buy the book and get at least some sense of my work. And so in summary, you know, I can say that integral philosophy is an exciting new perspective which transcends and includes the best of what's come before. It's not just a countercultural offshoot of progressive spirituality. It thoroughly incorporates and deals with mainstream philosophy, historical philosophy. It's intellectually rigorous, but hopefully usable by any reasonably intelligent person. And it offers the chance for us to see into the internal dimensions of the evolution of consciousness and culture. And you know, just like during the emergence of the modernist perspective, one of the benefits that I mentioned in the interview was that it gave us scientific medicine. You know, it gave us an ability to grab hold of the physical world with unprecedented power, and that led to all of the advances in health and happiness that have come from scientific mm-hmm. medicine, despite, you know, the fact that it's also brought, you know, environmental degradation, nuclear proliferation, you know, the problems are there as well. But clearly scientific medicine was one of the most tangible and one of the ways in which this modernist perspective, this new worldview that emerged 300 years ago, has improved the human condition in unmistakable ways. I think one of the promises of what might turn out to be a second enlightenment or the emergence of the equivalent of a historically significant, powerful new perspective that has a new way of seeing and a new understanding of what's true and good and beautiful from this integral philosophy perspective, from this evolutionary worldview understanding, one of the things that it can do is help us have a kind of a social healing, a healing of the psyche, a healing of the culture of the world in all the ways that it's broken and wounded. Not that it's a panacea for every problem, but when we understand that just about every problem we can identify, except perhaps a volcano exploding or something, can be understood at least partially as a problem of consciousness, right? Whether it's terrorism or, you know, nuclear proliferation, you know, environmental degradation, if we could change the consciousness that's either creating or failing to prevent these problems, we could go a long way in solving the problems themselves. And so this deeper understanding of what consciousness is and how it evolves, how it can be evolved through gentle persuasion, right, through values, through new truths, et cetera, is the great promise of this integral perspective. And I encourage people to read about it in the various books, new and as well as ones that have been around for a long time, that can help develop this kind of new, this new depth of perception that can see things in a new and powerful way. And, you know, that's why I'm into it myself.
Well, and that was a beautiful closing word there. We're out of time, but, boy, what a great place to leave it.
Thanks again for being with us, too.
Yeah.
Great
show.
Yeah,
and for Andre and for Crystalline and for Paula, thank you for being great hosts. I mean, part of a good interview is having good interviewers, and you all have been great, as well as our questioners. So I'm really grateful for this opportunity and really happy with how it turned out.
Oh, good. Well, we had
a full board
and lots of activity. So hope you get lots of great sales of your book and you know, hold high the mission.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Okay, all credit to the creator.
Yep, there you go.
Okay.
Well, have
Thank
a wonderful
so
week,
much.
And we'll hopefully talk with you soon.
Okay, looking forward to it.
Bye
Until
for
then.
Now.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.